What do George F. Kennan's newly published diaries tell us about the man and his times? Fareed Zakaria is here to talk about his review of the Kennan diaries.
George Kennan is probably the most was probably the most influential diplomat in American history who held no important position.
There's a new book about Hillary Clinton out. Does it reveal anything new? Jody Cantor will join us to talk about her review of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton.
Why are people surprised that this incredibly successful politician and diplomat is actually like an appealing person?
Julie Bosman will be here with Notes from the Field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Fareed Zakaria is the host of Fareed Zakaria GPS on CNN and the author of The Post-American World. He joins us now. He reviewed this week The Kennan Diaries by George F. Kennan, edited by Frank Castigliola. Hi, Fareed.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So this is really was a monumental editing task on the part of Castigliola, historian, I believe at the University of Connecticut. He had Kennan left over 8,000 pages of diaries during the course of his 101-year-long life. How well a job do you think he did in terms of getting this down to a manageable amount of material to go through?
From what I could tell, having read Kennan's memoirs, which are quite voluminous, having read several of his other books, particularly ones later in life, which were somewhat reflective, I think he's done a very good job of capturing the man in his many moods as he coursed through, you know, really the entire 20th century. So because what you see is this extraordinary journey of a young diplomat posted in Europe before World War II. Then you see the great man writing in the 40s and 50s and beyond, and then the disappointments which you begin to see in his later life, and he manages to capture all of that. What I was also struck by is he gives you enough material to see just what a beautiful writer Kennan was. There are some of those entries which he's left in there, and I'm glad he did, were just descriptions of the Wisconsin countryside or of a city that he would go to in Europe, Riga or something like that. And it was just it was written by somebody who had a kind of literary style that it's almost unimaginable for a diplomat to have today.
For listeners who are not familiar with Kennan's life or sort of vaguely know him as the author of The Long Telegram or the author of the concept of containment, tell us a little bit about who Kennan was.
George Kennan is probably the most was probably the most influential diplomat in American history who held no important position.
By right.
I mean, he was not Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. He wasn't ambassador to the UN. He was a man who became a Soviet expert. He was a Russian expert and then became a Soviet expert. And for a brief period, right at the end of World War II and the beginning of what we now think of as the Cold War, in 1944, 45, 46, he was a key advisor to the president and most importantly the Secretary of State. And what he was able to do was to recognize that the great challenge of the post-World War II age was going to be a great power competition with the Soviet Union, and that the nature of that great power competition was going to be very deep. It was inherent in the Soviet state, in Russian culture. And he proposed a policy that we now call containment, which was the policy that we followed for 50 years, which was don't try to roll back Soviet communism, don't try to liberate Eastern Europe, just put in place checks that will prevent Soviet expansion, be resolute about that, and trust me, the internal contradictions of the Soviet Union will eventually lead it to collapse. Which is precisely what happened in 1989.
I think it's hard for people to imagine now that policy, which lasted for such a long period of time and seemed a given, was not at all evident at the time that Kennan proposed it. Many people thought that war was inevitable.
Well, you started with people like Franklin Roosevelt, who felt that it would be possible to have a very cooperative relationship with Stalin and the Soviet Union. He really believed that the UN would be the kind of policeman of the world, and the reason was that he had ultimate faith in his ability to bring anyone along. And then, as you say, very quickly you move to people watching what the Soviet Union was doing in various places from Iran to Eastern Europe and said, my God, this is another version of Hitlerian expansionism, and we need to roll back and liberate Eastern Europe. Add to that the development of the hydrogen bomb, where the Soviet Union was becoming very powerful, and people felt we had this window of opportunity to really push very hard. Kennan came down right in the middle of all that, recognizing Soviet ambitions and intentions, but very strongly disagreeing with the idea of any kind of military pushback.
So he basically said that, and in his long telegram, which I'd like to talk a little bit about, said that no, Stalin was not breaking with Soviet or Russian history, rather, but that he was continuing in that same direction. What else did he write in the long telegram and then in his subsequent article in Foreign Affairs that was so influential?
The most important thing he made Americans realize, which is very difficult, I think Americans tend to think of foreign policy as a branch of psychoanalysis. It's Stalin is the problem, and if he were, you know, we see it even now with the whole debate about Russia and the United States is reduced to one about Obama and Putin, and Putin is really the bad guy. I'm not saying he's not. My point is, and what Kennan understood, was there are much deeper forces at work here. And what he tried to identify was the long strain of Russian history that had always sought a very large security sphere and a very large buffer zone between itself and Europe, and that this was inherent in kind of Russian imperial history. In addition, he was able to understand the nature of the Soviet and communist state, which was a highly authoritarian state that needed foreign enemies, that needed its state to be in a state of perpetual preparedness and emergency. And as a result, you weren't going to be able to find Stalin to be a cooperative partner. But then he also tried to explain that it was not necessary to, and it would be highly dangerous and provocative to roll back some communist gains, that you weren't going to be able to liberate Eastern Europe again, that was in effect a product of the fact that the Red Army was there when the Nazi empire collapsed, and so they were going to stay there. And so he was able to kind of chart this middle course with a great deal of subtlety and sophistication, which was not the mood in America at the time. As I say, we went from a kind of giddy cooperation with Uncle Joe to a point where the Secretary of Navy, James Forrestal, was openly calling for preemptive, perhaps even nuclear war against the Soviet Union.
Now, as you pointed out earlier, despite this great influence, Kennan himself never rose to the heights of power. He was worked in the Marshall State Department and also under Acheson, but he left these positions after brief periods. He was only the ambassador to Moscow for 5 months. In his diaries, how did he deal with that? I mean, was he regretful, frustrated, angry?
When you read the diaries and when you've studied his life, it is perfectly clear this was not a man suited to be a diplomat in the practical sense of the word. He was not particularly good with people. He was a proud, even vain man. He was very prickly, very sensitive. And so this is not exactly the guy who's going to be able to do the kind of glad-handing you need to. But in his mind, of course, this wasn't exactly what happened. So he's absolutely shocked and stunned that these kind of provocative remarks he makes when he's ambassador to Moscow annoy the Soviets, and they end up declaring him persona non grata and essentially kicking him out of the country.
He was the only person ever to be kicked out by Moscow.
Precisely. And he's stunned by this, and he can't believe it happens. And then he goes to Yugoslavia and the Kennedy administration and has a not particularly successful tenure there. What it turned out, he was really an intellectual who stumbled into diplomacy, and once he was able to, he kind of retreated into the academy. He ended up spending most of his life at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. It's the ultimate academic place.
Right.
You don't even have to teach courses. All you do is sit around, think all day, and write. And that was really the place probably he should have been, but it wasn't his perception. So the second half of the diaries are all about this sort of, there's a kind of wistfulness and there are the quality of the lamentation about if only people listened to me, if only I were there. And Henry Kissinger mentioned to me after we both happened to be chatting, and he had also read The Galleys, and he said, you know, the thing that I noticed in the years that I was in power was he so wanted to be back in the game. I wish I had realized it, because I would have given him some kind of position that
right.
would have allowed him to feel that way. I always thought he was, you know, he was doing what he was best at, which was writing about these things.
Now, Kissinger actually wrote a review for us 2 years ago when John Lewis Gaddis's monumental biography of Kennan came out, or not 2 years ago, in 2011. I know that Gaddis made great use of the diaries in that biography as well. And as you mentioned earlier, Kennan wrote his own memoirs in 1967. What do we learn in these diaries that you can't glean from the official biography in the earlier memoir?
I think what Gaddis used the diaries for in an absolutely wonderful biography was to describe Kennan the strategist, Kennan the foreign policy thinker. What I was struck by in the diaries, and what I ended up focusing my review on, was Kennan as the European conservative. Because what you really see in these diaries is that Kennan embodies a kind of strain of philosophical thought that is quite alien to the American system. Americans are by nature optimistic, future-looking, modern. You know, we've created a new country, we've created a new form of politics. So even the people we think of as kind of the conservatives in American history, John Adams, I mean, this is a guy who was breaking with the past, creating a new country, you know, believed it was a better form of government than any that had ever preceded it. And these are a kind of an embrace of the new. Kennan represented a very different tradition. He represented the classical European conservative who is always, not opposed, but always greatly perturbed by change, who sees society as organic, who sees the development of a society as necessarily a slow evolutionary process. You know, somebody like Edmund Burke would obviously be one of his forerunners. And what's striking, the metaphor that he often comes to in the diaries, which is fascinating and beautifully done, is travel. He talks about how he thinks that train and car travel, let alone planes, are ultimately just too fast. Because when you go from one place to another, you want to go slowly. You want to absorb the change that is taking place as you leave the first place you're going and you enter the new. And then you want to stay there for months, if not years, to understand that new place and that new culture. And so his feeling, the idea of getting to from New York to Chicago on a train in a couple, you know, in a few hours, was just too discombobulated.
Right.
Plane travel, he says, literally puts him in a psychotic frenzy. I think those are the words he used.
Reading your review, you feel so almost sorry for him for having lived to the ripe age, old age of 101, because you have this great excerpt you quote from 1927, in which he is already saying, "I cannot help but regret that I did not live 50 or 100 years sooner."
And I have a feeling, given Kennan's sensibilities, that he would have written that line no matter when he was born. That he, you know, he would have been one of those guys in the 18th century who was ruining the calamitous changes that were taking place. There's something about him that's very nostalgic, that's very backward-looking, but in a somewhat beautiful way. There are kind of nasty sides to it, to be sure, and you see that, for example, on race relations.
Right.
But for the most part, it's a kind of elegiac look at the past and a wistfulness about the fact that you know all change does mean you lose something. You lose some of the old. And he would focus a lot more on what was lost than what was gained in that process.
Well, it's also a very thought-provoking and well-done essay and review of the book. Fareed, thank you so much for joining us.
It was such a pleasure to write it. Thank you so much.
That was Fareed Zakaria, host of Fareed Zakaria GPS on CNN and the author of The Post-American World. He reviews this week in the book review, The Kennan Diaries by George F. Kennan, edited by Frank Castigliola. Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
What's going on?
This week is an interesting development in independent bookstore world. James Patterson, the blockbuster author of thrillers and mysteries and romance novels and anything else, any other genre that he can write in, has decided to hand over about $1 million this year to independent bookstores that are in need. And he's doing this in very small bites, between $2,000 and $15,000 per store. He released a list this week of the first handful of stores that are going to get money. And he says that he's doing this because he sees that not only bookstores, but literature as we know it is in crisis.
Now, James Patterson, of course, is not in crisis. He has a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list pretty much every week, at least one.
Including this week, right? They're the newly released list. He knocked the Goldfinch out of the number one spot with his latest book.
But he has emerged as a very strong advocate for literacy. Ads in the New York Times Book Review, ads in the New York Times and in Publishers Weekly and other publications, and events tied to getting children, especially boys, to read more. So does he see this as sort of an ongoing effort as part of that larger literacy campaign, or is there something else at work here?
He does. This is really focused on children's literature. As you said, he comes to this as a parent. He and his wife have a teenage son, and when their son was about 8 years old, he decided that he didn't want to spend much time reading in the summer. So I think that the Pattersons told him, you don't have to mow the lawn, but you do have to read every day. And their efforts paid off. Their son is now a very big reader. And he sees, or James Patterson says, that he thinks that kids don't have enough places to go to find books. They don't have enough bookstores in their communities in the way that they did in the 70s and 80s.
Libraries, too,
libraries
are suffering.
Definitely suffering. Their budgets have been squeezed for many years, especially since the recession. And he thinks that, you know, one way to try to encourage bookstores to get healthy is just by handing them over some money.
I like that idea.
It's a really good idea.
How about beleaguered journalists or mid-list authors? I think there's so many people in the world of letters who are in need.
Indeed. Barnes & Noble, why limit it to independent bookstores? But he is starting there because he said that, you know, he believes in the mission of independent bookstores. So he put the word out last year through friends and through his publisher, Hachette, that he was going to be handing out grants. And he said that he just needed a few paragraphs from each bookstore explaining what they would do with the money. And some of this is, you know, very, very simple. One bookstore in Asheville, North Carolina said, we really need some exhaust fans in the bathroom, and we really need new carpeting, and we need to replace the flooring. So that's what they're going to do with the money that they're receiving. And those checks are currently in the mail. They're supposed to be received by the end of the week.
New York City's very own Bank Street Bookstore also applied for one of these grants.
They did. They said that they would use the money to post and stream online video of their store events, which is really a reflection of the way that so many independent bookstores want to modernize and want to catch up with a lot of the technological innovations that have helped Amazon and a lot of their competition. There was one bookstore, Hickleby's, in San Jose, California, that said it wanted to buy a new computer system because its customers in the Bay Area are always commenting on how completely ancient their small screens with green print are, and they wanted to upgrade to a new system.
Any bookstores out there who have not yet submitted their proposal, sign up now.
There's another $750,000 coming later this year. So this is really just the first chunk. So,
all right,
Mr. Patterson.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
Jody Cantor joins us now to talk about her review of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. Hi, Jody.
Hi.
This is the big Hillary book until the really big Hillary book, her forthcoming memoir, which I think is scheduled for June. You know, of course, there have been many, many books about Hillary and the Clintons. What did you make of this book?
This book was such a big opportunity. Who would not love to sit down with a juicy account of Hillary Clinton's time as Secretary of State? And the timing is so potentially good because she's already running what seems like a proto presidential campaign. In some ways, as you said, this big memoir is going to be coming out in June, which will be a typical political memoir, I think. It's designed to support a candidacy, not to tell the truth and delve into every difficult issue.
Well, she already wrote that book, or at least theoretically up to a point.
I don't know if she ever has. I think we still have the question of when we're going to get a totally honest memoir from Hillary Clinton. Even that last book, Living History, was written to support the idea of her becoming a U.S. senator, right, and then eventually president. I think it was published while she was a U.S. senator. I once spoke to a Hillary aide who said that if she ever writes a totally frank book, it will have to be at the end of her life. I think the best we can hope for from her is a Katharine Graham style,
right,
assessment late in her life that manages to be candid while also remaining gracious.
You know, we were just talking earlier about George Kennan's diaries, which were recently published, and he made an agreement with John Lewis Gaddis, the Yale historian, that he could be his official biographer, but that the biography could not come out until after he died.
Wouldn't you love to know that? I would be so happy right now to discover that Hillary Clinton was having secret meetings with Annette Gordon-Reed or Doris Kearns Goodwin or Anna Quinlan, or somehow I want it to be a woman, of course.
Meeting the documents.
And exactly. A little bit like what Bill Clinton, her husband, did when he was president with Taylor Branch. Wouldn't that be great to know that she was stashing all of those memories for history? Because, look, the book we're talking about today, HRC, is a totally aide-spun book. There's some great stuff in this book, but on the whole, it is a product of the official Clinton narrative making machine. And so, as somebody who's done a lot of presidential biography myself, my worry is always that the people who really know the truth and who have the candid, unvarnished assessments, of course we know that they're not going to share them that widely in the present moment. My real worry is that they're going to burn the notes in the fireplace, right, so to speak, and not even share them for history.
So this book was written by two seasoned Washington political reporters. How good a job did they do in terms of getting people to talk? And did Hillary talk to them?
You know, they never say it outright. My impression is that she did not give them an interview. Remember that Clinton's aides knew that this was going to be coming out a few months before her memoir. So why would they give over the goods, meaning give the authors an interview with Mrs. Clinton, knowing that she has a platform that is entirely her own, that she can control to tell her story in June? They did. The authors spent a tremendous amount of time with Hillary Clinton's inner circle. And the greatest strength of the book is that they have these anecdotes that sort of bring to life what it is like to be in what's always been called Hillary world. There's a great scene of her coming back to Capitol Hill after she loses the Democratic presidential nomination in 2008, and her staff knows it's going to be a very depressing day,
right,
for her to go back to the Senate. A lot of her Democratic Senate colleagues had kind of stabbed her in the back during the campaign. So they stage a ping pong tournament, and she gets to the office and everybody's dressed in headbands and sweats and, you know, retro 70s style gear, and they're playing ping pong in the offices. And that just was delightful to read because it's so unexpected in a political context. What the authors did not do is deliver the kind of deep assessment that makes you understand what she was really like as Secretary of State. What I was craving from this book was what is it like to sit across the negotiating table from Hillary Clinton? My impression is that they really did not speak to a lot of foreign leaders, mm-hmm, or members of their staffs. So we don't really hear things like, you know, what is she like as an adversary? How can a negotiator there is a slightly airbrushed feel to the Hillary Clinton who comes out of this book. For example, she has pretty much a perfect relationship with Barack Obama, where they are almost always in accordance on every issue. And these two massive personalities who competed against each other so voraciously in the 08 campaign sort of flip a switch and get along perfectly. We know that there is truth to that because that is the uniform account that has come out of this administration. However, we also know that pretty much everybody in the Democratic Party has a massive interest in making us believe that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are the strongest of allies.
One of the interesting things about the timing of the book also is that it came out at about the same time as these papers came out from a former close friend of Hillary Clinton. And in a way, those seemed a lot more revelatory than what was in the book. Can you talk a little bit about what those diaries said? And obviously, it was dealing with an earlier period of Hillary Clinton's life.
It is a great before and after. Those papers are from Diane Blair, who was one of Mrs. Clinton's closest friends, unfortunately died at a very early age. So one of the mysteries of those papers is, why did she write down all of this intimate stuff about her very guarded friend? Those papers reveal just how difficult Mrs. Clinton's time as First Lady was. This is, you know, Hillary Clinton, circa mid-90s, somebody who is struggling to fully realize herself as a public figure, who's confronted with a level of vitriol and challenge that would overcome almost anybody, who is this brilliant person who finds that a lot of her preconceived notions about how to be in public life are really wrong, who is making huge mistakes at the time, everything from, you know, sort of misjudging the country's response to her healthcare plans to, you know, having this really sordid affair go on right under her nose, and initially defending her her husband when it all comes out. The Hillary Clinton in HRC is the ultimate pro. This is one canny operator. And you see the relationship between the two, right? If Hillary Clinton had not had such a bruising time as First Lady, would she be the politician she was today? You know, I'm always...
That's an interesting question. And do they address that, do you think, in this book?
They don't address that, but I do think there's something there because it's so fascinating that she ended up as a diplomat of all things. What was Hillary Clinton as First Lady? Incredibly undiplomatic.
Right.
You know, what do you think, I'm going to stay home and bake cookies?
Right.
You know, the famous stand by my man quote.
Interestingly, this again echoes an earlier conversation we had about George F. Kennan, who was also an incredibly undiplomatic diplomat, and perhaps says something about our approach to diplomacy. One of the things that people talk about often with Hillary is that, you know, she has this incredibly imposing and well-packaged exterior, but that when people meet her, they think they're sort of surprised that she's so likable or she's so funny or that somehow she disarms people and in personal interactions is different from her public persona. Do you feel like this book got through that public persona at all? And did you learn anything new, you who has written a lot about Washington politics? Learn anything new about Hillary from this book?
I did. I liked the glimpses into her life. Look, the value of interviewing aides, even though they're obviously not unbiased, even though there's a lot of spin baked into, you know, every sentence that they tell you, they have the access, and also there's a reason they went to work for these people, right? Philippe Raines. And the book, by the way, is almost entirely anonymously sourced, so you can't tell exactly who the authors are talking to. But the people they're talking to went to work for Hillary Clinton for a reason, right? They saw a vision of Hillary Clinton that was incredibly so appealing that they were essentially willing to attach their entire lives to it. And so seeing her through their eyes is not without value. It could have used a more distanced assessment. It could have used, you know, foreign officials and whatnot assessing her. But what her aides say over and over again, they've said it to me too, is that people don't see what a warm, candid, funny person This is, look, also it says something about gender, right? I mean, why is the baseline always that people think that Hillary Clinton is going to be nasty? Why are people surprised that this incredibly successful politician and diplomat is actually like an appealing person, right?
Right,
I mean,
right.
And somebody who, you know, has had the experience for decades now of learning how to make herself appealing to people all over the country and the world.
You, of course, also wrote your own book, The Obamas, which similarly, you know, tried to get inside the lives of these very public, hard to penetrate, very guarded public figures. I thought one of the best little moments, and then I'll leave the rest for readers to discover, that you said in your review is where Obama assumes that Hillary has told Bill about the assassination plan for Osama bin Laden.
Well, let's have fun with that for a second, because I think there's another layer there. The way the authors tell the story is that Hillary Clinton has stayed very close-lipped about the plan, the raid on bin Laden's compound. And so that Sunday night, President Obama calls President Clinton to tell him the news. And he starts out by saying, I assume Hillary told you. And President Clinton says, I don't know what you're talking about. So I think there are two possibilities there. One is that President Obama really did think that Mrs. Clinton told Bill Clinton what was happening. That would be within the tradition of the White House. Very often presidents have told first ladies about even the most sensitive national security information. First ladies are, in a sense, the one person from their own lives they can share it with. On the other hand, I also wondered, was Barack Obama needling Bill Clinton a little bit?
Right.
Oh, haven't you heard? You mean she didn't tell you? I don't know. I will leave that for us to ponder. I don't think we'll ever know the answer.
All right. Well, that and other Clinton mysteries and revelations in the book HRC, which is reviewed this week by Jody Cantor. Jody, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
In the hardcover fiction side, it is mostly series novels that are new, starting at the top with a new James Patterson book. James Patterson and Mark Sullivan have the latest in the Private series. This one is called Private L.A., new at number one. Then at number three, Jonathan Kellerman, a longtime regular on the list, has a new Alex Delaware book called Killer. At number eight, Alex Berenson, who has written a series of spy novels after leaving the New York Times, where he was a business reporter, has a new book called The Counterfeit Agent. Then new at number 12, not a series novel, actually a debut novel by a guy named Andy Weir. There's a new book called The Martian on the list. It's kind of a man against nature novel, except that the nature that he's against is outer space. It's about an astronaut stranded on Mars when he is left for dead by his crewmates, and they come back to Earth and leave him behind, and he has to figure out how to survive.
For those who didn't get enough lost in space feeling from Gravity.
Yeah, Sandra Bullock is not in this one. Neither is George Clooney, but who knows? Once it's turned into a movie.
All right.
Then on the nonfiction hardcover list this week, there are also four new titles, starting at number five. The science writer and New Yorker staff writer Elizabeth Colbert has a new book about the environment. She's really taken kind of environmental doom as her beat. Her last book was about climate change. Her new book is called The Sixth Extinction.
And the last book was also a bestseller, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
Those who say that, you know, people aren't interested in stories of climactic doom.
Well, she writes with a very lively voice, and there's kind of an understated humor in there. And she takes these giant, scary topics and makes them very understandable and very accessible. She doesn't hold out a whole lot of hope that things can get better.
Right.
But, you know, it's enjoyable to read about them in the meantime. So that book, The Sixth Extinction, reviewed on our cover by Al Gore, is new at number five. Then a couple of political books, new at number six, the book HRC by Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. HRC, of course.
Hillary Rodham Clinton.
You got it. And this is a look just at her time as the Secretary of State. It's not an overall biography so much as an assessment, analysis, and focused biography on those years that she was at the State Department.
And reviewed this week by our own New York Times correspondent, Jody Cantor.
This book will certainly be part of the dialogue in the lead up to the 2016 nomination.
Or the lead up to Hillary's own forthcoming memoir in June.
Oh, gosh. Then new at number 15, another somewhat political book, a book called Codename Johnny Walker, which is about an Iraqi interpreter who spent 6 years working with the American Special Forces during the war there, written by Johnny Walker with a ghostwriter. It's kind of an as told to a guy named Jim DeFelice. So that's new at number 15.
I thought you were going to say Jim Beam. Okay. Sorry.
Well, in keeping with that theme, new at number 16, just barely hanging on to the bottom of the list, is a book called Drinking and Dating by Brandy Glanville. Not a political book, the Real Housewife Brandy Glanville, whose last book was Drinking and Tweeting, has now moved on to Drinking and Dating. That book also has a ghostwriter, unsurprisingly. It's written with Leslie Bruce, new at number 16.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.